Okay, folks, welcome to the latest and I would say one of the greatest chapters in the history of life on planet Porky. And the reason I say that is because the Rock Chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, is, of course, with me in our studio, as it is, the sort of, what do you call these studios, Miss Jones? They're not real studios, they're sort of...
Virtual studios.
Thank you very much. And, of course, the big issue for me today is I'm going to start the podcast with a song, Miss Jones. Freedom!
Oh, no.
Freedom! Why am I singing that, Miss Jones?
Is that a song? Or is that just a word that you've put to a few notes?
I think it was George Michael's song, wasn't it?
Freedom! Oh, okay, sorry. It was unrecognisable in its current form.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So of course, today, in fact, in about half an hour's time, I'm going to walk into a pub the first time in...
What, this morning?
Yes, this morning, 15 months. I'm going to walk up to the bar and order a pint of beer, which the bar person will hand to me, put it on the bar, then I can pick it up and walk away and go and sit down at a table. That's what I call freedom. You know, the idea of having to walk into pubs with a mask on. I'll keep my mask on walking in until I sit down at my table because I want to protect other people, i.e. the bar staff and that kind of stuff, okay? But, you know, the idea that you have to go and sit down at tables and like, I hate it. But anyway, there we go. It's freedom day.
Well, I will tell you this, that my son and youngest daughter, both of whom have been working in, well, one in a pub, one in a bar, sort of summer jobs, they both were pinged and they're both self-isolating.
Golly.
And they both... had contact with a COVID positive person at their place of work.
Yeah.
So I think pubs and bars are still one of the most infectious places. So I'm being very cautious about going into these kind of joints.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. And of course, we are premiering this week, Miss Jones, aren't we?
Oh, yes, we are.
Yeah.
We are going out on the town in the West End.
We certainly are. We're going to the Odeon Cinema in Leicester Square. And we're going to see a new film, Off the Rails, it's called, isn't it?
Yeah, it's The Music of Blondie.
Ah, right, okay.
Which I'm sure a lot of people will be jumping up and down at the thought of.
Yeah,
there's never been a musical or a film that's really focused on their music, so I'm very excited about this.
Yeah,
I used to do Blondie's press when I worked at Chrysalis Records years ago.
Debbie
Harry is one of the most delightful people, by the way, who I've ever worked with.
Yeah, I bet she is, yeah. And also one of the most glamorous rock stars of my lifetime anyway, her and Stevie Nicks. Of Fleetwood Mac. But no, that'll be fabulous. And so it'll be like an hour and a half film, will it?
Yeah, it'd be about 90 minutes to... It's usually 90 to 120 these days, isn't it?
Yeah,
I get a bit itchy after about an hour and a bit, you know. I don't really rate these films that go on for hours. There used to be a trend, didn't there, of films that would last about 4 hours with a couple of breaks in between.
Oh,
and you'd go back and sort of have the second bit and then the third bit. And... Oh, God, I just want to run out by halfway through, really.
Yeah. The guy
My attention span is quite short.
And mine as well. The guy who makes those Reservoir Dogs films, you know, the very...
Quentin Tarantino.
Tarantino. He did make one for 3 1/4 hours non-stop, I think. And
Was that
The Irishman?
Was that Inglourious Basterds or something?
Something like that. I thought it might have been The Irishman, you know, which is
the
Mafia or something like that. I'm not sure. But anyway, I agree with you. I like a Top Gun type film. An hour and 40 minutes, go in, lots of action, bang, and you're out again. Or Rocky or something like that. You know what I mean?
Leave you wanting more. That's the kind of film I like.
Well, that's absolutely right. Anyway, there we go. I've been watching the other Liz, your great friend Liz Jones, on the box this morning. And She's caused a great discussion point. She went out in a fat suit and to find out how it is for obese people in society and all that. Now she's been attacked from all sides, you know, that, oh, you know, it was a ridiculous stunt and how could you possibly think she was fat with this little tiny head coming out of this huge fat body and, you know, putting herself into the minds of a fat person isn't a physical thing, it's a mental thing. So it was quite a brave experiment, I suppose, wasn't it?
Well, I'll tell you the real reason why she did this.
Yeah.
because she's just launched a novel called 8½ Stone.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, it's a novel, it's fiction, but it's basically her. It's a story about her. She's a very skinny bird, and
yes,
she looks after herself. She is very into her image and so on. Hmm. So this novel about struggling to keep your weight down to 8½ stone, which is quite unrealistic these days, but to promote her novel is the real reason why she's doing that.
Yeah, okay. Well, good luck to her. And
good luck to her. And also, congratulations to her, because she's just won the Columnist of the Year Award in the popular category for her very soul-bearing column in the back of You magazine, the Mail on Sunday.
Very good. That's excellent. And congratulations.
So we're very pleased for her, aren't we?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. No, that's great. She was talking this morning about another one of the reasons she's done it. She's had eating issues all her life. Anorexia as an 11-year-old, had to be force-fed and was sectioned at one stage when she was a teenager. I mean, she has had an action-packed life, hasn't she?
Yeah, she has. She seems to have fallen foul of every fence, really. Yeah. Everything that could have reared up to challenge her as a young woman. It's hit Liz. She's been through it all. Yeah. But she writes so candidly and so honestly and so soul-bearingly about all her negative experiences. And I think it helps other people because, first of all, they realise it's not just me. Mm. You know, other people go through this stuff. And to hear somebody else explaining how they dealt with it and overcame it, I think is very helpful to people. So I couldn't do what she does, but all power to her.
No, absolutely. Now, I've read a review of a new book called Under the Volcano, Miss Jones, and it's about Montserrat, and in particular about the recording studio AIR run by the fifth Beatle, Sir George Martin. I bet you know a few stories from that era, huh?
Well, I remember it so well because George Martin and John Burgess, who was his business partner, ran Air Studios from the same building we worked in as Chrysalis Records.
Ah.
It was in Stratford Place, just off Oxford Street.
Mm.
And this was back in the early 80s. They kind of founded their own studio because they were a bit sick about how, well, for example, George Martin produced all the greatness for the Beatles, but he was very poorly paid for that.
Yeah.
And there came a time when he thought, bugger this, basically, you know, I'm going to break out by myself and make some proper money doing what I do best. So they founded Air Studios and they also built their own recording studio on the island of Montserrat, which was at a time when it was very popular even among musicians and bands to go to exotic locations away from the madding crowds, focus on the music and record in a fine location where they could also enjoy swimming and snorkeling and hanging out and partying with the locals, all that kind of stuff. But being away from home. So the idea was that they would focus on the music. But, of course, Air Studio, everybody recorded there. McCartney, Sting, Duran Duran. Everybody was out there recording.
John, Duran Duran, you're right, Lou Reed. It says that his son Giles, by the way, who's carried on his legacy, says one of the aims was to separate musicians from the army of hangers-on, groupies, drug dealers who disrupted recording sessions and came between the artists and their producers, not to mention their bandmates. That worked for some of the bands, but in this review I read, others were driven simply mad by the isolation of it all, you know. And one artist in this review said, I couldn't make music in the peace and the silence of Montserrat. I had to come back to London. I wanted to hear noise on Oxford Street, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's horses for courses, really.
It is, and there is proof that they certainly weren't separated from the drug dealers. There was a lot of drug taking going on, as in any exotic location studio, you know. But there are two sides to that coin. I think some people just don't like being that far flung.
Mm.
But the tragedy was with Air Studios that it got swept away in a hurricane.
Yes.
And the basic buildings are still there. And a friend of mine has visited quite recently for a photographic project.
Oh.
A girl I know called Christina Jansen.
Yeah.
Jansen, I should say. She's Dutch. And it's just a sorry shell of the great, glamorous, productive, creative hub that it once was.
Mm. Chernobyl, the Chernobyl of the music world.
Just Chernobyl, not, even,
not,
yeah.
Chernobyl, even, yeah, that's right, yeah. Talking about rock stars, and of course you know lots of them, and lots of rock stars to talk about today. I don't know if I feel sorry for Brian May. We've spoken about Brian May before, and we know he's got all sorts of projects, apart from being a rock god with Queen. He's not a physicist, an astrophysicist, I think, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes, he is.
And he campaigns for badgers and all that kind of stuff. But his home has got a cellar which was recently flooded in the heavy rainstorms in London, and it has ruined a lot of the memorabilia that he'd collected from his Queen years. But not only that, his lovely wife, who was Angie in EastEnders, what's her name?
Anita Dobson.
Anita Dobson, that's right. All her memorabilia has been rotted and ruined by sewage water that poured into their basement. And they are blaming the fact that in the posh areas of London, you know, Kensington and Pimlico and all around there, people build these, what do they call them, iceberg basements, where they literally dig down until they've got enough room to put a swimming pool under their houses. And Brian May's blaming that for wrecking the basically the water level, you know, across that part of London, because a water level is the level to which you can dig before water comes up the other way. And he says it's had a terrible effect on all these millions and millions of pounds worth of houses.
It's a tragedy, isn't it? I mean, we've seen in the news entire houses just collapsing.
Yes.
And, you know, 17th century mansions, glorious buildings that ought to be preserved. Mm. But because of all this digging, which is literally shaking the foundations and, as you say, affecting the water table, suddenly they're dropping into the ground. And they need to worry about this, because this will continue. I don't think that those old properties, really, the foundations of them, can stand that kind of excavation for the sake of a swimming pool underground. I mean, what are they talking about? The tragedy here is that no amount of insurance money can ever replace those unique artifacts that they've lost.
No.
Because even if you get the money out of the insurance company, which, of course, they are going to argue about till blue is white, they can never be replaced. They were collected over a 50-year period of time. This, in the future, would be like destroying the artifacts within Tutankhamun's tomb.
Yes.
You can never get those back.
No, I totally agree. They call them iceberg excavations. I tell you who suffered very badly from that, and it might have even led to the sort of end of his TV career. You remember Matthew Wright, don't you? Was Matthew at The Sun when you were there?
Oh, he was there long after me, but I do know who he is.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he went on to become a TV star, and in fact, he did the show Matthew Wright on 5, which is the mid-morning show on Channel 5, which has subsequently being supplanted by Jeremy Vine on 5, a show I sometimes occasionally appear on, you know. But I knew Matthew for years, and Matthew was driven mad by, he lives in a very nice posh neighbourhood, and one of the neighbours got going on one of these iceberg basements, which went on for 2 years, and he said that, you know, he had a nervous breakdown because the vibrations from the work day and night filtered into his building, all into his own home all the time. And the walls shook and the roof was shaking. And apparently there's nothing you can do about it once the local authority have given you permission.
There ought to be laws against this kind of thing.
Should be.
Because that, if he had a nervous breakdown over that, that's literally destroying lives.
Mm.
And why should he, when he's paid a fortune for his property, his home, his Englishman's home is his castle, why should he have to put up with that around the clock? It's appalling.
It is appalling. I totally agree. Talking about appalling, you and I have also spoken before about Amy Winehouse's dad, Mitch, okay? What do I see? I see a spread in the newspaper now. I'll make sure Amy's remembered for the good she gave the world, not for her troubles, says her dad, Mitch. And there's a load of Amy Winehouse stuff coming out this week, Miss Jones, as I'm sure you know, because it's the 10th anniversary of her tragic death at the age of just 27. And there's a lot of people jumping on a lot of bandwagons at the moment.
There's a good documentary called Reclaiming Amy, which is coming out this Friday, the 23rd. And I think my daughter, who works at Island Records, was telling me that this is Island's project.
Right.
And they are doing this. And I saw a trailer where Mitch and his former wife, Jane, were talking, Amy's mother. Mm. And they were saying that to this day, people come up to Mitch in the street and say, you killed your daughter. Mm. You know, you exploited your daughter. And that he said that we are doing this for Amy to give her real story back to herself so that her memory is preserved. Because also her best friend from drama school, who I think is called Tyler, somebody I seem to remember reading a couple of days ago. He's written a book. And
yes,
Mitch,
I've read
and,
the excerpt of that one,
the parents have issues with this because they say that his version of the story takes liberties with the truth. And they're very upset because they used to look upon Tyler as a second son. That, you know, he was one of the family. They trusted him. He was Amy's best friend. And he seems to have brought about some injustice to her memory. So there's that angle as well. It's very difficult when somebody's died because everybody has their story. And quite often those stories conflict. The way people remember somebody is not necessarily untrue if it conflicts with somebody else's memory of that.
No,
do you know? It's a very subtle distinction, I think.
Well, look, the reason why you had the opportunity to write a new book on John Lennon is because these people were so famous and lived such great lives, there's always going to be something new to find out about them, isn't there? Because it's so fascinating about all their lives. By the way, I understand the paperback version of that book's out at the moment, Miss Jones. How's that going?
It's been great, thank you. I've been all over the place the last week or so. I've got another week of it this week. Doing local radios up and down the land, some televisions, a couple of things in America, a couple of stuff in Australia. We did a great event in Holland Park on Saturday afternoon, which was a word in the park. It was a talking event at the opera venue there. So it was a very lovely location. And there was Gary Crowley, who is a radio presenter. I used to work with him on Channel 4 presenting a rock show. Danny Baker, of course, Mark Lewisohn, the world's greatest authority on the Beatles, and myself. We all sort of got up and hogged the stage for a bit and told rock and roll war stories. And it, and then we saw books afterwards. And it was a great afternoon, actually.
Yeah, excellent. I'm delighted. Now, Miss Jones, if you lost your left foot, you'd probably notice it, wouldn't you? You know, as you're...
Oh, God, how horrible is this story?
Police have launched an appeal to try to trace the owner of a severed left foot found on a footpath 2 years ago. Forensic and DNA tests have failed to identify them, but experts confirm the foot came from a 5'2" woman aged over 16 who was found by a dog walker at New Waltham, Lincolnshire in April 2019. What a... I mean, you and I have been in the newspaper world for decades, but you've rarely come across a story like that.
Well, do you know what? It made me think immediately that a whole person was killed, obviously quite a tiny woman, and that the rest, this body was probably chopped up, and that the rest of the woman is elsewhere, probably distributed throughout the land in different locations. So maybe the rest of the body parts will turn up at some point, or maybe they will have, what's the word, when they just kind of disintegrate and rot away.
Well, rot away, that's what happens, you know. And they're not,
but why did not the foot rot away? Why? What? Sorry, that wasn't it?
You know, you read these horrible stories about people who are murdered and then they're chopped up and put in suitcases, literally, and hauled away somewhere. And it might have fallen out the suitcase or something like that. You know, I mean, who knows? It's just...
It doesn't last very long. It's like if you get a leg of lamb from the butchers or something, if you just leave it on the kitchen table after a couple of days, that is going to start to smell disgusting, and that's going to have to be thrown away. I think that flesh doesn't stick around too long before it start to...
It doesn't. It's a very, very bizarre story, which I don't really...
So it could be a newly chopped off foot, which begs all kinds of questions,
doesn't it,
really?
Of course it does, yeah. Yeah,
but you'd know if your foot was missing. That's the point, isn't it?
Of course you would, unless you were very high on some sort of drug. Now, I'll tell you who I'm sorry to have to report has died, Tom O'Connor. I don't know if you remember him, do you? He's a bit before your time, to be honest, and he's died aged 81. But there used to be a show on ITV on a Saturday night called The Comedians, and it was all... It was working class comedians who did the working men's clubs around the north of England, and lots of people came out of it. Les Dawson came out of it. The one who, you know, hey, the Germans bombed our chippy and all that. You know, they all came out of it. One of them came out of it was Tom O'Connor, but he went on actually to carve out a great TV career. His most famous one, you may remember this, Leslie Ann, from having watched repeats of it decades later, Name That Tune. Do you remember that TV show?
Was it Name That Tune in 4 or 5 or something like that? They gave them, the contestant said that they would name it in however many notes.
It was something like that. I can't quite remember. I never watched it. I thought it was so hopeless. But
it was a rip-off. It was a rip-off of a programme that was on Capital Radio for some years.
Oh, was it?
Called Beat the Intro.
Oh, really? Oh,
and right. I think okay. Phil Swern, Phil the Collector Swern, I believe, was the producer of that.
Yeah.
And so it's obvious, it says it on the tin. They would play the introduction to a song before the vocal kicked in, and you'd have to say what the song was. Yeah. So I think they ripped it off from that.
Oh, they probably did. But the reason I mention it is we met him once, Alan Brazil and I were at some fan event, you know what I mean? And it was largely to... It was what we call a fans forum. Al and I sit on the stage and, we have questions thrown at us from the audience and all that kind of stuff. And for some unknown reason, Tom O'Connor was there because he was a big Liverpool fan. So it must have been somewhere in the northwest, probably in Liverpool or Manchester or something like that, you know. And we got together after and had a few drinks. And he told me what I still think is the funniest joke I've ever heard. He says, "Yeah, mate, I've got a joke for you, and it suits you down to the ground." I said, "What's that?" He says, "This fella goes into a supermarket and he buys one egg, one tomato, one rasher of bacon, one slice of bread, and one piece of black bun. And he goes to the checkout, and the checkout girl smiles at him and says, 'Hey, I bet you're a single man, aren't you?' And the guy says, 'How did you work that out then?' She said, 'Because you're so bloody ugly.'"
Oh, that's a horrible joke.
No, it's not. It's great.
That's not very nice.
No, it is, because the idea that this guy's buying one of everything means that, you know, well, he must be a single man and he eats on his own and all this kind of stuff. But no, she says you're so bloody... Anyway, I thought it was funny.
The thing about a great joke is that you should never have to explain it, right?
Well, exactly. So maybe it's a generational thing, you know? Maybe
they did a competition, didn't they, a few years ago, and people had to vote for the finest joke of all time.
Oh, really?
And this is the one that won it. Let me see if I can remember it correctly. Yeah. It was, did you hear about the man who had a little dog called Cigarette with no legs? He used to take it out for a drag every night.
He's taking it out for a drag. Yeah, that's supposed to be the funniest joke of all time.
That was supposed to be the funniest joke, and it officially won the competition.
Yeah.
And you sit there thinking, next?
Mm-hmm. You do. If anybody ever says to me, "Oh, do you want to hear a joke?" I always say no. And I'm not being rude. I never laugh at jokes, you know what I mean? I just don't. So a bloke in a pub or something trying to be, hey, listen, I've got a good joke for you. No, not for me, you haven't. You've got a good joke, go and tell somebody else, pal. Don't tell me, thank you. You know, I can't.
Thing about jokes as well, they're almost always at somebody else's expense or something's expense.
Yes.
They're almost always poking fun at something or other.
Yes.
For a disability, like that poor little dog, or, you know, the poor guy with cooking his breakfast for one.
Yeah.
It's always a sad connotation, I think, to standard jokes.
And to be honest, you know, I'm of an age now and mixed in so many different variants of company. I've heard all the jokes anyway. There aren't any new jokes, you know?
No. Like that line where, you know, they say there's only 7 plots to a novel.
That's right.
There's a book, I've got a book somewhere, actually, that tells that. It spells them all out. And it is all films, all stories. Most films are made from books anyway. Yeah. But there are only 7 basic plots. And there are probably only about 7 joke themes as well.
I think so. I like jokes that are told by my mate Tim Vine, okay? Because they're simple, they're clean, they're childish, but they're charming. Like, for instance, you know, so I was having a clear out at my house and I decided I'd get rid of the Hoover. After all, it was only standing there gathering dust. And, of course, you wouldn't call it a Hoover, Miss Jones. We've had that conversation before. But
we won't go there again.
We'll go there.
I used to like all the silly ones, like knock-knock jokes and, you know, just of daft stuff, really.
Yeah.
Things that kids laugh at. I've always liked that kind of thing.
Mm. No, I totally agree. Innocent, and it brings back an age of innocence. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. The heat wave is receding at last, thank God. God, heat doesn't half get me, Mr. Jones, I'm telling you. Talking about heat waves, heat wave, of course, we've talked about in California, but also in California, Miss Jones, Adele has just bought her third mansion, you know, an exclusive area of Bel Air or Hollywood or something like that. She's now got a third house. They're all next to each other. She's going to put together a huge sort of, you know, super mansion over a number of acres and join all the houses together. I mean, And I've read actually just this morning she's got a new boyfriend, so maybe she's going through a new phase of life. But it's a huge change, isn't it, for a young girl who came from, where'd she come from, Dartford or Deptford or somewhere?
Tottenham, I thought.
Tottenham, you're right. I think it's Tottenham, definitely. Yeah.
So I did know her a bit in the past because she was at the Brit School at the same time as my eldest daughter.
Oh, yes, that's right.
My eldest daughter was studying theatre and Adele was obviously doing music. But there did used to be gatherings back at our kind of, you know, Jones Towers.
Yeah.
And it would be quite amazing sometimes. There would be, thinking back on it, I mean now, it wasn't amazing at the time to have Adele, Katie Melua, Amy Winehouse, Luke Pritchard from the Kooks, all these people gathered in your kitchen unstucking your dishwasher and that kind of thing. Yeah, but they were only kids back then, and there was no indication of what they were going to go on to become, you know. But it's no different, is it really, from the Beatles coming from the back streets of Liverpool to become the greatest group of all time and among the richest men on earth, or the Rolling Stones, or whoever else you want to pick, really. I think maybe people think it's a bit unusual because she's a girl.
Yeah, well, maybe, or maybe she did it so effortlessly, didn't she? You know, she produced an LP. Was it called 21 or something like
19 that? 19 was the first one.
So she produces an LP. It's called 19, so it doesn't take a great deal of thought. You know, there's no deepness in it. And there was a load of great songs on it. And bang, all of a sudden, she's a multimillionaire. It says here her worth is now 143 million quid. I always try to work out where people keep 143 million quid. You know what I mean?
Well, you buy lots of properties, join them all together, and you have a sort of, she's creating Adeleville, obviously. There is such a thing as a bank, you know, they do still exist. So people, tend to keep their money in the bank, I'm sure.
Yeah, but do they just have like £143 million in cash in the bank? So if they went and said, could I just check on my balance, please? Oh, yes, it's £142,754,050. I can't believe people keep money like that. They must keep it in like gold bars in Switzerland or something, I think. I don't know.
She's just been bled of about half of it by her ex-husband, hasn't
she? Yeah, that's right.
Which is really sad because she loved him and they had their little boy together and everything. And then obviously she was traumatized by the split because she went and lost more than half her body weight. And she used to big up how happy she was being a larger lady. And she was a champion for the cause of bigger women, wasn't she, as well?
Yes, you
are. That it's okay to be the size you are and celebrate your uniqueness, whatever else.
Yeah.
She obviously felt pressurized. He must have left me because I was fat. And then she goes and loses a ton of weight. It's not that easy to do, but it's much easier for a younger woman than it is for an older woman to lose weight. And now she's obviously dating again. I haven't yet heard her sing since she lost the weight. And what I'm interested to find out is whether her voice sounds any different.
Wow. What a good point. You mean?
Because Freddie Mercury famously did not have his teeth fixed.
Right.
Because he thought that it would affect the construction of his, you know, within his jaw and his throat and all that kind of thing.
Sure.
And that it might affect his voice. So I'm looking forward to hearing Adele sing in her new guise to see whether that's affected her voice in any way.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very good point. Talking about that, by the way, you mentioned jaw and teeth and all that. I know we talked a little bit about masks and things earlier in the podcast, but I did my first self-test at home yesterday. And I found it a very strange experience. Have you got a self-test kit?
Yeah, I've had a couple, actually.
Yeah, well, I got my first one last week. I thought, well, I suppose I better had. What I couldn't understand was, and this absolutely bemused me, I read through the instruction leaflet, and it said, get the swab and put it in your mouth, but don't let it touch your tongue or your cheeks or your palate. Put it right to the back of your mouth and rest it on your tonsils. Well, I don't know where my tonsils are or what they look like. I've never seen them.
You didn't have them out when you were a child?
I don't know. I can't remember.
You didn't swallow them by mistake?
No, of course not. But
roughly the region of your tonsils, don't you? It's that back, the very back bit of your throat where you see that little kind of wobbly bit coming down.
But does it make
I can't remember the name of.
Does it make you gag when you put the...
Yeah, it does me, yeah.
Right, well, in that case, it was in the right place, so that's okay then.
That is a horrible experience. It's like in the dentist when they go right to your back teeth, and I always gag at the dentist.
Yeah, it's horrible,
it's nasty, because you don't get over that for about an hour.
No, and then you have to stick it up your nose, which isn't very pleasant, you know what I mean? All this kind of stuff.
That bit doesn't bother me, actually. Ooh. I don't mind the up the nose bit, but I do strongly object to down the throat. If you know what I mean, and it is a family show.
Yes, it is a family show, Miss Jones. And but you know, nevertheless, I can hear you chortling and chuckling now. Just to get another racy comment in. You know, just now then, it's no secret you're writing a new book on the Rolling Stones. So what a good day for me to tell you that on this day in 1964. Because I used to love her, ba-bam, bam, but it's all over now. The Rolling Stones' first number one. How about that?
Do you know who wrote the song?
Well, I assumed it was Jagger and Richards.
Nuh-uh. It was written by Bobby Womack and Shirley Womack, actually. It was first released by the Valentinos, featuring Bobby Womack, and produced by Sam Cooke. Ah. And their version of the song, released in America, peaked at 94, so it didn't do very well.
Yeah.
The Stones first heard it on their very first North American tour in 1964, and they loved it so much that they recorded their version of it 9 days later, even though Bobby Womack said they weren't to. He was really anti them doing it because he thought it would affect the success of their own recording of it.
Yeah.
So he told Jagger to go and get his own song. Anyway, they didn't listen. 6 months later, when Bobby Womack received the royalty check for this Stones recording of his song, Sam Cooke went and told Mick Jagger that he could have any song he wanted.
Right.
So they soon turned around there, didn't they?
Yeah, I bet they did. So was that Womack and Womack then, the famous...
Well, that was Bobby... it was Bobby Womack. Or was it another Womack? There were so many Womacks.
Oh, were there? Right. Okay.
Yeah. In about 1984, Womack and Womack had a hit... I can hear it in my head and I can't remember the name.
Was it Footsteps on the Dance Floor?
Yes, it was. Well done.
Footsteps on the Dance Floor.
And it was another Womack and his wife.
You. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember that, yeah. That's interesting. Well, after that then, after, you see, I thought, wow, that's a great bluesy song. It's all over now. That was a great...
Yeah, it wasn't there. It wasn't an original. It was a cover.
And after that, did they write all their own then? You know, like...
They did other covers.
Yeah.
Well, the Beatles obviously gave them Come On, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, yeah. They did. McCartney and Lennon. The version I read was that they all met up somewhere in Soho by accident, right? You know, some coffee bar, or they were moving from one studio to another. And Mick Jagger said they were desperate, they didn't have a song. And the Beatles, at one period, were writing songs so fast, it was like they had an electric typewriter which had gone mad and just kept churning words out. And McCartney actually said to Jagger, oh, don't worry, we've got one fight for you, haven't we, John? John said, what? You know, that one. Oh, yeah, OK, yeah, they can have it. Yeah, come on. And all that kind of stuff. So there we are. That's so interesting.
Mark Lewisohn was very interesting on that subject, talking at the weekend. Mark Lewisohn, the Beatles expert, historian, at the event in Holland Park. And he was saying the Beatles were so prolific because they got bored so easily.
Right.
And they were constantly writing and coming up with stuff. It was just flowing out of them like an exploding volcano, like lava.
Yes.
And it didn't hurt them to give songs away because they had too many to process themselves.
I read somewhere that Paul McCartney thinks he might still have another 200 songs, you know, somewhere, you know, scribbled down on paper and musical ideas and all that kind of stuff, which he's never got around to recording.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, but he's, 79 almost?
Yeah.
He needs to get a move on, because how tragic it would be if he died and we didn't get to hear all those songs he hasn't recorded yet.
Well, somebody will find them. I bet you somebody like...
Yeah, but they won't be recorded by him. That's the point.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So
we'd rather have them recorded by him. So I think he needs to pull his finger out.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I'll tell you what's interesting. I got this... I read all the book reviews all the time, okay? And there's this one called The Authority Gap. And it's a passionate new book reveals how even today women are belittled and patronised and some of the world's most successful reveal how they've beaten men at their own game. And it is a great book, which says that, you know, even to this day, there is an inherent bias within society by men against women. And people have been trying to get over it for like hundreds of years. But because of the DNA of the male and the female, it's almost impossible to breach.
Yeah, this is by Marianne Siegert, who used to work for The Times, didn't she?
That's right.
She was an executive at The Times.
Yes.
Yes, a good, succinct writer, and she's right, of course. It is still there. It does still exist. And I think the primary cause of it is resentment. Men don't want to be usurped by a woman. It threatens their masculinity.
Yeah, I think that's
and, right. And too many men are too traditionalist, and they believe a woman's place is in the home, and they will actually say that to a woman.
Yeah.
Which is, it's terribly sexist, and it has no place in the workplace today.
Mm. Well, look, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I came from a nuclear family, as I think you did. We had a mum, dad, and three children. We lived in a semi-detached house. My dad went out and worked every day, and my mum looked after us and got us out the house to school and then did all the washing while we were out and then all the cleaning. And then at 4 o'clock when we came in, she was back, you know, in place, you know, making the dinner, washing our PE kits, all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
And she was a slave. Just as my mother was. They were a slave to domesticity and running a home and being at the beck and call of a man.
Yeah, but my mum liked doing it. That's the point. She always
said... She didn't have a choice, probably. She maybe wasn't qualified to do anything else.
Yeah.
And maybe with just your father's one income, the same as in our house, there wasn't the money to employ other people to do the domestic chores so that your mother could go out and work.
Yeah. No, it's true. There's a paragraph here in this review. Why should this tendency persist? Thorning Schmidt, who's that? That's some specialist that Marianne Siegert has spoken to, says, I do believe it's a hangover from the caveman era. Cavemen went out to hunt and cave women reared the young. We are people who walk around with a brain that is wired to be extremely prejudiced against female leaders because it just goes against the grain of what our Stone Age brain can capture. So it goes back that far.
Well, it does. But, you know, we live in the 21st century now, and we can't let that hangover still affect the way we live and work today. There are going to be women, always, who would prefer to stay in the home, stay indoors, look after the kids.
Yeah.
I have to say, a lot of those women are quite lazy. They don't want to do anything else. I know women who have armies of cleaners, gardeners, nannies, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
They go out to lunch and they play tennis with their girlfriends. And then in the evening, the husband comes home, they get the kids to bed, and then they go out to dinner. So she doesn't even cook. Mm. And there is a sort of middle class layer of people who live like that until the man gets quite fed up with it, wakes up and thinks, well, she's just living off me and doing nothing. Mm. And he goes out and gets himself a newer model, and the poor woman gets thrown aside.
Yeah.
So I think women need to wake up a little bit about this as well. In lower house home incomes, where both parties are forced to work simply because they need to get that money in to pay for their lifestyle, it doesn't seem to be an issue. Most women and men seem to have jobs in that category.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But further up the scale, there does seem to be some choice involved still. I think women shouldn't waste themselves in that way.
Yeah, well, you know, I perfectly respect everything you've said. I was told this story once to just to prove how that prejudice still exists in society. So this chap jumps in the car at home and his son jumps in and they're going off to a football match, okay? So father and son, dad and lad, are in the car and sadly the car is involved in a fatal crash on the way to the football ground in which the father is killed at the wheel. The son is taken out of the car on a stretcher in an ambulance, taken to the hospital, rushed into the theatre, and the paramedic briefs the surgeon and says, you've got to operate on this young boy immediately to save his life. And the surgeon says, I cannot operate on this boy, for he is my son.
Okay. So, hang on. I'm trying to... That's yeah. So the dad died in a car accident.
Yes.
Now, I can't work that one out. Tell me.
The surgeon is a woman and the boy's mother.
Got it. Okay.
See what I mean?
Got it. So I instinctively assume that the surgeon was male. Isn't that interesting?
That's exactly it. That was told to me to prove that very point as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe, I feel right? ashamed for not yeah. having made that connection. Yeah. Yes, that's awful. How awful.
Yeah. That's the Leanne. Excuse me a second. A cat's just invaded my garden. Won't be a sec. Hang on.
I'll just talk amongst myself then, shall I? I'm trying to drag up a joke that I could tell to fill the interim of Mike saving his potted plants from the cat.
Oh,
okay.
Dear me. I live in a
what did you do with the cat? Because you're in a roof garden. How did it get there?
It got there by climbing over the roof. This is the very point.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah. So I live in a penthouse, right? And there's another one sort of diagonally opposite, right? And this cat is a cunning cat. There's a tree that leads.
Wonder what you were going to say then.
Yes, I bet you did. Yes, there's a tree that leads up to the roof garden of the other penthouse flat, and the cat is a wily creature. It goes up the tree, gets into that garden, and then, and I've seen this happen before. You've heard of that very famous play, Tennessee Williams, "Cat on a Hot Tin Roof," right?
Mm-hmm.
This cat can literally get up the drain pipe. From the roof garden onto the roof and then run round the roof of the flat opposite and jump onto my roof, honestly. And then it comes down into my garden. And what it's after is not my plants. I've got a bird bath and it comes after the birds. So I have to be very vigilant at all times.
So that cat has heard that you're a bird feeder and it wants some of what you're, because you're attracting the birds.
Yes.
So you might be luring those poor birds to their death.
Well, I get mad with the cat when I find it. I spray it with water and all that kind of stuff, you know. I didn't want to hurt the cat, obviously, but it can't be around to kill birds. It only happens very, very occasionally. And as I was talking to you then, I've got the back door open, obviously, into the garden because of the enormous heat that we're suffering at the moment, but I saw it stealing past, so I thought I'd better go and sort it out.
Could you not put a bit of net up, as they say?
Well, you could, but I mean, that looks unsightly, doesn't it? And cats anyway are very...
You can't see it. Who cares, really?
Well, that's right, yeah. But I mean, cats are very resourceful. And, you know, you can put all sorts of things up to keep cats out. But they're sly and nasty and dangerous creatures.
Oh, you don't like cats,
no,
do you?
I don't.
Yes,
no,
I remember.
No.
Why don't you do this? Why don't you get some of those spikes that you put up to deter pigeons?
Well, it would just jump over them. What I have done in the past, but I've been a bit idle, is you can go to the pet shop and you can get an anti-cat spray, right? And you can put it along the top of the walls and all that, and that will work. So that's my first mission for today. I want to tell you a story about, sorry, it sounds like a bit of an obit's corner because poor old Tom O'Connor, the comedian, has died. But another chap who's died is called Andy Fordham. And you may just remember him through the fact that your dad was the, you know, top sports writer, Ken Jones. He became world darts champion in 2004. But unfortunately, Andy was so heavy that he could hardly move. He could barely move. He weighed at one time something like 25 stone, and he got up to 31 stone because he drank 20 pints of beer a day. He was a publican. And he was a publican. He used to play darts in his own pub, then suddenly got very good at it, then won the world championship, then got even heavier because people would come to his pub just to see him. And, of course, he never paid for a drink for the rest of his life. And it's a sad story that he's died now at a very young age, 59, from overweight.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, poor guy, rest in peace and all that. But
yeah.
Surely he knew what he was doing to himself.
Yeah. Well, he did, obviously. He freely admitted to never playing competitive darts without having consumed at least 15 bottles of Stella Lager before the competition.
That's terrifying. I wouldn't even be able to see straight after 15 bottles.
Well, you wouldn't get anywhere near 15. Honestly, knowing your sort of consumption levels, Miss Jones, you'd drink 3 bottles of lager and that would be it, honest to God. And I wouldn't drink many more. I'd maybe 5 at most, you know what I mean? But an amazing bloke. He freely admitted never playing darts without 15 bottles. He said he needed to aid his concentration while combating shyness. Similarly, free-flowing end-of-game imbibing was commonplace. It's remarkable, that, you know, because when you think of the effect that alcohol has on your ability to focus, concentrate, all that kind of stuff, that's why people should never drink and drive, because just a pint and a half of beer and you're over the drink drive limit, you're a danger to other drivers on the road. This guy would drink 15 pints and then still be able to throw a dart into an area which is approximately 1 inch wide and 1/4 of an inch deep. It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, I suppose he practiced a lot if he was a publican. That's probably all he did in his spare time.
Yeah.
Just chuck darts at a board. I mean, it's a bit of a waste of a life, isn't it? But I suppose there was no danger of him being over the drink drive limit because I'm sure he couldn't fit inside a car.
No, he couldn't. He couldn't, seriously. He had to get to competitions in the back of a van and all that kind of stuff, you know. By the way...
Poor guy.
Yeah, poor guy, yeah. It was the British Grand Prix last weekend and guess who turned up? Tom Cruise.
I saw that. He was in the pit. Yes, he was rooting for Lewis Hamilton, who's in a big load of trouble, isn't he, again now?
Who, Lewis Hamilton or Tom Cruise?
Yeah. Did you see the crash?
Oh, yeah, crashing people off the course. I mean, that was a trick that Michael Schumacher used to employ, right? If Schumacher thought that the person in front of him was going to beat him, didn't bother trying to overtake him, he just drove him off the track. It would either be Damon Hill or Alain Prost or something like that, you know, because Schumacher was such, a winner, he couldn't let anybody else win. And it seems like Lewis Hamilton might have taken up that that particular trick. And, of course, the guy he drove off the track, Max Verstappen, who's the head of the Drivers' Championship, although with a much reduced lead now, was very angry, and so was his team. His team, by the way, Max Verstappen's team, is led by Christian Horner, okay, which brings us nicely to
Jerry Horner's husband, yeah.
Exactly, brings us nicely to our last topic today in the podcast. Christian Horner runs Red Bull, married to Ginger Spice. What was her name before it was Horner?
Jerry Halliwell.
That's right, yeah. And I see that one of last weekend's bumper editions, Sunday newspapers, was fabulous. Spice Girls special, Viva Forever, how five fierce females conquered the world. We celebrate 25 years of the Spice Girls. And I think we should as well. I think they were wonderful.
Do you know what? I mean, who cares, really? Who really cares?
Oh, no, they were cultural, honestly. They were a phenomenon. They
were cultural?
Yeah, of course they were, yeah.
Seriously?
Well, yeah, of course they were. They were the most successful and biggest girl band ever, and I think they deserve some credit for that.
They had a moment, and I don't take that away from them. I wouldn't dream of it. They had a moment. It was 25 years ago. Or shall I tell you what? All those little girls who adored them grew up.
Yeah.
And for some reason, you know, we can still idolize the Beatles, the Stones, whoever else, but it doesn't work for girl groups. Why do you think that is? Because little girls grow up and they find something more serious to pay attention to.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure that's true because they had reunion concerts 18 months ago and they sold out.
They weren't that successful, actually. They cancelled the tour some little way into it.
Oh, did they?
They cancelled the rest of it, yeah. No. And, of course, Victoria Spice didn't want to go on the road with them either.
No, well, I don't blame them, really, no.
I mean, I don't think that music has really stood the test of time. I just don't. If I hear one of their hits on the radio,
yeah,
I don't sort of jump up and down and think, oh, God, this was such good music.
No.
They were a phenomenon. They weren't music, were they, really?
Well, I think that's probably true. The only one I'd ever recognise, really, is Wannabe, because it was the first one, wasn't it? And it established them. Yeah, I agree with you. Musically, I can't see any. I mean, presumably those songs were written by Stock, Aitken, and Waterman, or whatever, weren't they?
All writers like that. I think maybe the girls themselves had some input, at least later on, as they matured as musicians, if that's what you can call them. Yeah. But they were a moment in time. They encapsulated that point in the 90s, and they gave little girls, you know, there used to be Spice Girls dolls, but like Barbie dolls and stuff like that, which kind of spells out really who their audience was, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Every little girl, because, you know, my mates used to have little children growing up then, and the phenomenon was for a little girl to come in the room and start singing into the back of a hairbrush. You know what I mean? Like, I tell you what I want, what I really, really want, you know. So it gave, as you quite rightly say, it gave a lot of little girls a lot of joy. So we're glad about that. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another podcast. Thank you very much indeed. We should give our audience of millions, Ms. Jones, just a bit of prior warning that we are both planning holidays in August, which is something I'm really looking forward to after a tough 16 months. What about you, Ms. Jones?
Yes, I'll be heading off to stay with my friends in Italy, whose swimming pool is finished. Oh. Hooray! Oh. So we'll actually be able to get some swimming in. I so miss swimming. Do you miss swimming?
No, not really. I'm not a great swimmer, to be honest. Whenever I go abroad, I don't spend very much time in the pool and a lot of time in the bar next to the pool. But,
I bet you're one of those people that likes those swim-up pools where you can swim in and you have there's a bar in the pool. Do you know those kind of resorts?
Oh, absolutely.
And the people you love are the ones who tip their pina colada all into the water. In fact, I heard somebody call it once a penis coladas for that very reason.
Oh, my God, honestly. Let's just lower the tone of the...
You can rely on me.
Absolutely. Okay, folks, so that's it for this week. Thank you very much indeed. Take care in the heat. It's receding now, but it hasn't gone just yet. Ms. Jones, be back with you and the audience again very soon.
Looking forward to it.
You read these horrible stories about people who are murdered and then they're chopped up and put in suitcases, literally, and hauled away somewhere. And it might have fallen out the suitcase or something like that. You know, I mean, who knows? It's just too
horrible. It doesn't last very long, is it? It's like if you get a leg of lamb from the butchers or something, if you just leave it on the kitchen table after a couple of days, that is going to start to smell disgusting, and that's going to have to be thrown away. I think that flesh doesn't stick around too long before it doesn't start to.
It's a very, very bizarre story, which I don't really.
So it could be a newly chopped off foot, which begs all kinds of questions, doesn't it?
Of course it does, yeah.
But you'd know if your foot was missing. That's the point, isn't it?
Of course you would, unless you were very high on some sort of drug. Does it make you gag when you put the...
Yeah, it does me, yeah.
Right, well, in that case, it was in the right place, so that's okay then.
That is a horrible experience. It's like in the dentist when they go right to your back teeth, and I always gag at the dentist.
Yeah, it's horrible,
I know. It's nasty, because you don't get over that for about an hour.
No, and then you have to stick it up your nose, which isn't very pleasant, you know what I mean? All this kind of stuff.
That bit doesn't bother me, actually. I don't mind the up the nose bit, but I do strongly object to down the throat, if you know what I mean, and it is a family show.
Yes, there's a family show, Miss Jones, but you know, nevertheless, I can hear you chortling and chuckling now. Chernobyl, the Chernobyl of the music world.
Chernobyl,
Chernobyl, even, yeah, that's right, yeah.